Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Hamas warns of a stronger response while the Islamic Jihad mobilizes its armed wing as anger boils over the death of two Palestinians at the hands of Israeli forces in Jenin. The UN chief warns that Afghanistan's economy risks falling into a death spiral without urgent aid, as some 95% of Afghans do not have enough food to eat. And Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan rejects opposition calls for him to resign while accusing a Western country of backing moves to oust him. Thank you for joining us. Israeli forces have stormed Jenin refugee camp and clashed with Palestinians, killing two youths and injuring 15 others. The Islamic Jihad resistance movement says it's mobilizing the Al-Quds brigades in response to the Israeli violence. And Hamas has also said such episodes will end in a stronger response from the Palestinians that will affect the whole occupied territories. Mona Candy reports from Ramallah.
A fresh round of violence by the Israeli military has erupted in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Jenin refugee camp, killing two Palestinians and wounding 15 others. The army stated that its forces stormed the camp to arrest suspects in connection to Tuesday night's operation in Bnei Brak, one of Tel Aviv's suburbs, which led to the killing of five Israelis and the perpetrator Dia Hamashi from Yabet town near Jenin. During the funeral procession of the two youths in Jenin, mourners vowed to avenge their killing, saying the operation was meant to satisfy the angry settlers.
Israeli forces raided Jenin's refugee camp and the city with large numbers of armored vehicles to kill people in cold blood and to commit more crimes just to satisfy the settlers. It's a criminal regime with its military.
Following Jenin's raid, Israel declared a military operation, dubbed Wave Breaker, to stem what it described as a rising tide of terrorism by Palestinians. In 1 week, Tel Aviv was shocked by three lethal series of operations in lands occupied since 1948, leaving 11 Israelis dead.
The current Zionist regime doesn't want an escalation to keep its internal status, despite a call for Israelis to carry arms. At the same time, it gives the settlers free hand along with the military practices.
What happened in Jenin today was a real massacre against the Palestinian people under clear Arab and international inaction and silence. What Israel is doing is not different from the terror organization's crimes.
A third Palestinian man was also shot dead after claims he stabbed and injured an Israeli man with a screwdriver on a bus near the illegal settlement of Efrat and Gush Atzion settlement block between Bethlehem and El Khalil. The Israelis are calling for a military campaign in the occupied West Bank, demanding a painful response. On the other hand, Palestinian resistance groups have vowed to respond to Israeli crimes, saying they have their hand on the trigger. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Members and supporters of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas have held a ceremony in southern Lebanon to mark the 46th anniversary of Land Day in Palestine. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh took part in the event and sent us this report.
Islamic resistance movement Hamas in Lebanon held a mass rally to commemorate Land Day in the southern town of Saida. Hamas leaders considered this event as an occasion not only to remember Palestine, but a day to resist.
Land Day has become more significant with the qualitative operations which are occurring in Palestine, especially the last operation, which is the slogan for the upcoming phase. This will be the state of Palestinians in the West Bank, in Al-Quds, in the lands of 1948, the state of declared and continuous struggle against the Zionist enemy, backed by a capable resistance in Gaza. Land Day this year is being commemorated with an aroma of victory, of heroic endeavors to prove that the land is ours.
Hamas also says Israeli policies of annexing land and building settlements have not stopped the Palestinian nationals from their struggle.
Today, the Palestinian people and behind them, the Palestinian resistance, are sending a message to the Zionist entity that Palestinian land will not change its identity. This land will remain Palestinian, Arab and Muslim, and the Zionist occupation, with all its crimes and swallowing of more land and building settlements, will not be able to change the national identity of Palestine.
Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, many of whom were born and raised in Lebanon, say they grow more attached to Palestine day by day. Every generation becomes even more determined to return.
In the Meir Meir refugee camp in Seda, the youth, the men and women, everyone were joyous and cheering after they heard of the excellent operation. They were even saying that liberation is near and that Eid has come earlier this year. This was the situation in all the camps, and this proves that day by day our children, women and men are attached to the land of Palestine and have more hope in liberation.
Speakers at the rally stressed that the resistance in Palestine is stronger than ever, with the support it has from the entire resistance alliance in the region. Land Day is commemorated by Palestinians all over the world as a pivotal date to mark their attachment to their land. With recent unprecedented events, the people's resistance, even in land occupied by Israel in 1948, is growing more vibrant, making the dream of liberating Palestine more possible than any time in the past. Mariam Saleh, South Lebanon.
An official Iranian delegation has concluded a two-day visit to Syria discussing prospects of expanding bilateral relations in various sectors with the Arab country. Our correspondent Mohammed Ali reports from Damascus.
An Iranian parliamentary delegation arrived in Syria headed by Deputy Parliament Speaker Ali Nikzad. He met with Speaker of Syria's People's Assembly Hamoud Sabbagh, hailing the distinguished relations between the Syrian and Iranian parliaments. Sabbagh expressed appreciation to Iran's steadfast and principled stances in support of Syria, especially in its war on terror.
The Iranian government and parliament were and remain standing beside Syria and President Assad. We in the parliament will ratify any draft resolution with regards to cooperation with Syria. We will give all permissions to the Iranian government to cooperate with Syria and help developing it.
The top legislator also met Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal al-Miqdad, who called for enhancing economic relations for the benefit of the two nations, condemning unilateral sanctions by the U.S. and its Western allies on Syria and Iran. Nikzad expressed Iran's willingness to increase the bulk of trade exchange and economic partnerships with Syria.
Strategic relations with Syria will never break. Iran will continue to support Syria in the reconstruction phase. We reject the U.S. unilateral economic sanctions on Syria, and Iran will spare no effort in assisting Syria in the fuel, economic, and trade sectors.
The Iranian lawmaker also held a meeting with Syria's Prime Minister Hussein Arnous. Both officials underlined the importance of removing any obstacle in the face of implementing agreements signed between both states, as well as increasing the number of joint investment projects. The visit comes as a reiteration of the brotherly relations, not just between governments, but also the peoples of the two countries. The exchange of officials' visits between Syria and Iran recently increased with the aim of boosting economic cooperation. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
The UN chief has painted a dire picture of life in Afghanistan, warning that people are selling their organs and children to survive.
Without immediate action, we face a starvation and malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. People are already selling their children and their body parts in order to feed their families. Afghanistan's economy has effectively collapsed. There is very little cash. More than 80% of the population are in debt.
Guterres said some 95% of Afghans do not have enough to eat, and 9 million are at risk of famine. Speaking in a high-level donors conference, he warned that Afghanistan's economy risks falling into a death spiral without urgent aid. He said wealthy countries cannot ignore the consequences of their decisions on the most vulnerable. The Taliban seized power in Afghanistan last year after the chaotic withdrawal of U.S.-led forces. The United Nations is seeking a record $4.4 billion in funding for the war-ravaged country this year, but so far has received less than 13% of the amount. Earlier, journalist and author Daniel Lazar told us how the U.S. is perpetuating the Afghan suffering and the West's double standard in dealing with the crisis.
U.S. is embarking on a very punitive policy. America likes seizing financial assets. It's seized Afghanistan's. It's now seizing Russia's. Essentially, it's using its preeminent position in the global financial structure to strike back at countries it doesn't like. And the consequences in Afghanistan are shocking. I mean, Afghanistan's a country of 40 million people. Apparently, 95% of them are food deficient. More than 10 million children face starvation. This is a catastrophic collapse. The U.S. is doing nothing. It's not only just doing less than nothing, it is stealing Afghanistan's financial assets. And evidently, Europe and America divide the world up into two parts. There are those who have blue eyes and blonde hair and come from countries like the Ukraine, and those who are darker skinned and come from either from Latin America or Asia or Africa. And they're treated very differently.
The Pakistani Prime Minister rejects opposition calls for him to resign ahead of a parliamentary no-confidence vote. Imran Khan says he is facing a foreign-backed conspiracy to oust him.
People will never forgive nor forget you, nor will people forget and forgive your handlers. People will always remember that you made a deal on the country. The people here under foreign influence tried to topple a government that had an independent foreign policy.
Khan said a Western country is backing the move because he had visited Russia recently for talks with President Vladimir Putin. He didn't openly name the alleged conspiring country. Opposition leaders have been calling on the premier to quit before he loses the majority support in parliament. The main ally of Khan's government, the Mutahida Qaumi movement, has already announced leaving the ruling coalition and joining the opposition. The opposition now has the required numbers and the 342-member assembly to oust Khan and his administration. The government faces accusations of corruption and mismanagement amid high inflation and soaring unemployment. The no-confidence vote will take place on Sunday. Political commentator Liaghat Ali Khan says the United States wants Imran Khan removed from office as he tilted Pakistan toward China and Russia more than the previous governments.
Prime Minister Khan is making two arguments. The first is that the United States is interfering into the domestic politics of Pakistan, and the United States does not like the independent foreign policy of Prime Minister Khan. I think this claim is valid to a large extent because Imran Khan is trying to take Pakistan towards Russia and China, more so than the previous governments, and obviously the United States does not like it. PM Khan is also making a second claim, which is that the opposition parties, they are conspiring with the United States to unseat him. So they're like 9 or 10 political parties, including about 20 members of his own party who have defected. All of them, they are dissatisfied with the domestic policies of Prime Minister Khan. So Prime Minister is making this claim that these 9 and 10 political parties are conspiring with the United States to unseat him. Mm-hmm. And I think this claim is unbelievable because this paints all political parties who oppose him as traitors to the country. And I don't think the people will accept that claim.
Turning to the latest developments on the ground in Ukraine, where a Russian military offensive is now in its fifth week. In eastern Ukraine, pro-Russia forces are reporting significant progress. These forces claim they are in control of almost all of the Luhansk and more than half of the Donetsk regions. They controlled about a third of each of the two regions before the Kremlin recognized their independence last month. Moscow has said a full liberation of these territories is now a primary goal, as Ukraine's military capacity has been seriously degraded. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned that Russia is massing its forces for a big offensive in the eastern region of Donbas. NATO also says it is not seeing a pullback of Russian forces in Ukraine.
According to our intelligence, Russian units are not withdrawing, but repositioning. Russia is trying to regroup, resupply, and reinforce its offensive in the Donbas region. At the same time, Russia maintains pressure on Kiev and other cities. So we can expect additional...
Stoltenberg said he expects additional offensive actions by Russian forces in Ukraine. Local officials have confirmed the death of 20 people as a result of Tuesday's rocket strike on the regional administration building in Ukraine's southern city of Mykolaiv. Russian forces have encircled the southern port city of Mariupol. They've announced a local ceasefire in the city for Thursday to allow civilians to be evacuated. Ukraine says it's sending a convoy of buses to evacuate them. Russia says it will stop gas supplies to purchasers from unfriendly states, including all EU members, unless they switch to payments in rubles from April the 1st. In a televised address, the Russian president said he had signed a decree on the issue. Vladimir Putin said foreign buyers must open ruble accounts in Russian banks from which payments would be made. Putin stressed that nobody sells Russia anything for free, and so Moscow was not going to do charity, as he puts it. Western governments and companies have rejected Russia's demand as a breach of existing contracts, which are set in euros or dollars. But Moscow says matters have changed given the Western anti-Russia sanctions over the operation in Ukraine. Europe imports 40% of its gas from Russia, and a halt to supplies will plunge it into a full-blown energy crisis. Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Microplastic pollution has been detected in human blood for the first time, with scientists finding the tiny particles in almost 80% of the people tested. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's environment editor, Damien Carrington. The piece is titled, Microplastics Found in Human Blood for First Time. Microplastic pollution has been detected in human blood for the first time, with scientists finding the tiny particles in almost 80% of the people tested. The discovery shows the particles can travel around the body and may lodge in organs. The impact on health is as yet unknown, but researchers are concerned as microplastics cause damage to human cells in the laboratory. And air pollution particles are already known to enter the body and cause millions of early deaths each year. Huge amounts of plastic waste are dumped in the environment, and microplastics now contaminate the entire planet, from the summit of Mount Everest to the deepest oceans. People were already known to consume the tiny particles via food and water, as well as breathing them in, and they have been found in the feces of babies and adults. The scientists analysed blood samples from 22 anonymous donors, all healthy adults, and found plastic particles in 17 individuals. Half the samples contained PET plastic, which is commonly used in drinks bottles, while a third contained polystyrene, used for packaging food and other products. A quarter of the blood samples contained polyethylene, from which plastic carrier bags are made. Our study is the first indication that we have polymer particles in our blood. It's a breakthrough result, said Professor Dick Wathak, an ecotoxicologist at Vrije Universiteit in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. But Professor Dick Wathak added, "We have to extend the research and increase the sample sizes, the number of polymers assessed, etc. Further studies by a number of groups are already underway," he said. "It is certainly reasonable to be concerned," Professor Dick Wathak told The Guardian. "The particles are there and are transported through the body." He said previous work had shown that microplastics were 10 times higher in the feces of babies compared with adults, and that babies fed with plastic bottles are swallowing millions of microplastic particles a day. "We also know in general that babies and young children are more vulnerable to chemical and particle exposure," he said. "That worries me a lot." The new research is published in the journal Environment International and adapted existing techniques to detect and analyze particles as small as 0.0007 millimeters. Some of the blood samples contain two or three types of plastic. The team used steel syringe needles and glass tubes to avoid contamination and tested for background levels of microplastics using blank samples. Professor Dick Wathak acknowledged that the amount and type of plastic varied considerably between the blood samples. "But this is a pioneering study," he said, "with more work now needed." He said the differences might reflect short-term exposure before the blood samples were taken, such as drinking from a plastic-lined coffee cup or wearing a plastic face mask. "The big question is, what is happening in our body?" Professor Wathak said. "Are the particles retained in the body? Are they transported to certain organs, such as getting past the blood-brain barrier? And are these levels sufficiently high to trigger disease? We urgently know to fund further research so we can find out." The new research was funded by the Dutch National Organization for Health Research and Development and Common Seas, a social enterprise working to reduce plastic pollution. "Plastic production is set to double by 2040, said Joe Royal, founder of the charity Common Seas. We have a right to know what all this plastic is doing to our bodies." Common Seas, along with more than 80 non-governmental organisations, scientists and MPs, are asking the British government to allocate £15 million to research on the human health impact of plastic. The European Union is already funding research on the impact of microplastic on fetuses and babies and on the human immune system. A recent study found that microplastics can latch on to the outer membranes of red blood cells and may limit their ability to transport oxygen. The particles have also been found in the placentas of pregnant women and in pregnant rats. They pass rapidly through the lungs into the hearts, brain and other organs of the fetuses. A new review paper published on Tuesday, co-authored by Professor Dick Wathak, assessed cancer risk and concluded More detailed research on how micro and nanoplastics affect the structures and processes of the human body, and whether and how they can transform cells and induce carcinogenesis, is urgently needed, particularly in light of the exponential increase in plastic production. The problem is becoming more urgent with each day.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends, and here is an aphorism from Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, the Prophet's 16th infallible successor. If a person observes his brother in faith performing something evil and does not prevent him in spite of his ability and authority to do so, then he's really treacherous to his brother.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Now, we find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim's life, in all of its various dimensions, is distinguished in a few things. First of all, he is distinguished in the firmness and the strength for which he stood up for when it came to the right, to truth, to haq. We also find his steadfastness in front of all kinds of events, trials and tribulations, good or bad. And we also see Imam Musa al-Kadhim's luminous behavior, his actions, his morals, and his ethics, of which no deviation or crookedness has ever been reported. And finally, the life of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam is marked by balance. It is in harmony with that of the life of the Prophet Muhammad. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام لا دين لمن لا مروة له.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, "He who has no valorous qualities has no religion."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we find in the beautiful conversations and dialogues of the seventh divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that these beautiful dialogues and conversations with his companions and his relatives and his friends and the people around him were so profound and so beautiful and had this world of meaning in these conversations and these dialogues. In one such conversation with one of his companions, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam advised his followers and his companions and those who believed in him as a divinely appointed imam to consult each other in respects to their affairs and to not be obstinate and stubborn. And so we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam said to his followers, "Whoever consults with others is praised during correctness, and whoever consults with others is excused during committing a mistake." Now, this is such a beautiful statement that we find in this dialogue of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam with his companions and his followers, and talking about the importance of consulting with others. Now, just as a precursor, we must remember that we're not talking about consulting with anybody, you know, and everyone. Of course, there are certain people that you consult with over specific matters. So, for example, you're not going to necessarily go and consult with your doctor about whom you should marry. Or likewise, you're not going to go and consult your car mechanic for example, health advice, right? You go and you consult with people based upon their expertise. Now, moving forward from here, whoever, as Imam al-Kadhim says, whoever consults is praised during correctness. Because when you make a correct decision or you took a correct path, well, because you had asked advice from others, you had consulted experts, and so therefore, when you do take the correct path, this is praiseworthy. But on the other hand, if you are stubborn and obstinate, and you don't want to listen to other people, you think that you are always correct, And therefore, you don't consult with others. You don't take other people's advice. You don't take expert advice. Well, then you commit a mistake and you didn't consult others. Then that is your fault. You should have consulted somebody. But on the other hand, if you committed a mistake, but you did consult other people, you did take the advice of other people, well, then you are excused because you did try your best. So this is the importance of consulting experts and taking the advice of experts in the different parts and aspects and matters of our life. This is Dialogue. Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Atar, the producer of this program, and at this moment I want you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
The life of the seventh Imam is quite unique, as they say that he was the Imam for the longest period of time compared to other Imams. His imamat period was about 35 years, which seems to be the longest compared to all the other imams. For about 20 years, he was in the service of his father. As we all know, the sixth imam, the renowned personality of the sixth imam, how influential he was for the entire ummah, for the entire Islam that we have or that we have remained today, is indebted to the sixth imam. Whether that be the school of Shafi'i, Maliki, Hanbali or Hanafi, they are all indebted to our sixth Imam for enhancing them with jurisprudential principles, with Islamic knowledge that they themselves eventually started to carry out ijtihad and form their own schools.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
The cherry blossom or sakura season in the Japanese capital is a magical experience as trees burst into bloom, dousing the streets with stunning shades of pink. This year, people are enjoying the occasion to the fullest as COVID restrictions are no more there. Thousands gathered in central Tokyo wearing masks, taking pictures and posing for selfies among the trees. Cherry flowers reach full bloom on Sunday, 4 days earlier than usual, according to the Japan Meteorological Agency. The age-old tradition of viewing cherry blossoms typically takes place across the country. The flowers are a national obsession. People flock to parks to hold parties and picnics. However, due to the pandemic, authorities have asked people to refrain from eating and drinking outdoors.
Millions of people across the world celebrate Earth Hour, a symbolic Lights Out event that aims to call attention to environmental issues and the necessity of protecting the planet. The annual event encourages people to turn off their non-essential lighting for an hour and take a break from using electronic devices during that period. Earth Hour takes place every year on the last Saturday of March. The theme of this year's event is Shape Our Future, and has been celebrated in more than 180 countries, including Greece, France, Thailand, and Iran. The initiative was first introduced in 2007 by the World Wildlife Fund as a grassroots movement for highlighting the collective responsibility of the people towards their environment. An ancient place in Guatemala with special significance for the Mayan culture could be the next entry on the World Heritage List. The historic village known today as the Takalik Abach Archaeological Park was occupied for 1700 years before it was abandoned and discovered in 1888. It's said to have been home to a pre-Hispanic people. Archaeologists found their way to this mysterious piece of land where they found a series of exotic artifacts and sculptures back in 2008. Guatemala's Minister of Cultural Heritage says this site has a sacred place in the nation's culture.
Takalik Abach is a sacred place with important links to Guatemala's culture. It's a place that harbors flora and fauna biodiversity and even Mayan spirituality and war is wild. This makes this place highly important within the Mayan culture in Guatemala.
Archaeologists believe the monuments go back to the deep-rooted civilizations of Olmec and Maya in a Central American culture around 400 BC. The government has presented the site to UNESCO, hoping it will be declared a World Heritage Site. A Belgian-British teenager is on a solo flight around the globe that could make him a world record holder. Mark Rutherford started his journey from a small airfield near the Bulgarian capital Sofia on Wednesday. His first destination is the island of Sicily in Italy. From there, he'll fly south to Africa and then around the globe to cross the finish line again in Bulgaria. The 16-year-old pilot says he got his inspiration from his sister.
Egypt's rich history seems to be a gift that keeps on giving. The country has unveiled some exquisite, newly discovered tombs. The pharaonic tombs were found at the Saqqara archaeological site south of Cairo. The site is a big necropolis of Memphis, an ancient capital of Egypt. The graves belonged to a senior royal official, or rather senior royal officials. Some of the graves are engraved with interesting titles such as Steward of the Royal House and Supervisor of the Garden. The tombs are around 4,000 years old, dating back to the Old Kingdom of Egypt.
Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, is celebrated worldwide by millions of people, including the people in Indian-controlled Kashmir. The region, known for its natural beauty worldwide, turns magical each year during its spring season. To mark nature's revival, the people of Kashmir have dedicated a day to thank the mesmerizing beauty of spring. Our correspondent Shahana Bhatt reports.
As the spring season begins in Kashmir, the earth turns lush green and the trees bear colorful blossoms, with the sky visibly blue and waters clear and glossy. After a not-so-harsh winter this year, the people of Kashmir are welcoming the onset of spring. Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, marks the beginning of spring and is celebrated on March 21st. New trees are planted while people offer prayers and seek God's help for a prosperous year.
Each year, we await this season so that we can plant new trees. The process of their growth gives us hope, and that hope teaches us that God has set a time for everything. We can't fast-track it. We can only do our best efforts.
On the occasion of Nowruz, women in Kashmir prepare unique dishes made from lotus stem and fish. Mehra and her sister have a busy day today. Friends and family are invited to relish the moment.
We have been taught by our mothers and grandmothers to cook these delicacies on the special occasion of Nowruz. It requires lots of dedication, and what matters is that this food brings friends and families together, and a lot of positive energy is exchanged. For us, Nowruz is not just an occasion, but it marks a fresh beginning of love, growth, and prosperity.
On the occasion of Nowruz, the Kashmiri administration often organizes musical festivals to add fervor to the celebrations. People, especially children, visit these musical festivals in large numbers so that the year starts with cheerful memories. This year, scores of tourists have also come to witness Kashmir's spring.
We had heard that Kashmir looks magical, but we witnessed in reality that this land looks fabulous, especially the spring season.
The early arrival of tourists has added a lot of positivity to Kashmir's tourism sector, which has been hit hard by years of political instability and turmoil. Persian culture is deeply rooted in Kashmir, and celebrating Nowruz is a sign of its influence.
Nowruz marks a new beginning, and after suffering decades of political instability and 2 years of the COVID pandemic, people are only hoping for a return back to a normal life and an everlasting peace. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Turkey inaugurates the world's longest suspension bridge over the Dardanelles Strait. The bridge is more than 2 kilometers long and connects Turkey's European and Asian shores. It cuts travel time between the two locations to just 6 minutes. A consortium of Turkish and South Korean firms began constructing the huge bridge in 2017 with a budget of 2.5 billion euros. 5,000 workers participated in the colossal undertaking. Passenger vehicles must pay a fare of 200 Turkish liras or around $14 to use the bridge. In Peru, paleontologists have unearthed the skull of a ferocious marine predator that is an ancestor of the modern-day whale. The 36-million-year-old skull was dug up intact after it was discovered in Peru's southern desert. The fossil belongs to an ancient mammal whose contemporary descendants include dolphins. Recreations of how the animal looked like show it mostly resembles a giant lizard that moved like a snake. Paleontologists say it was a top predator measuring some 12 meters long.
The discovery is very important because the skull is in a perfect state of preservation. The skull and the jaw are in the right anatomical position. The teeth are complete. It's very possible this might be a new Basilosaurus species. If this is so, there is no other fossil like this one anywhere else in the world.
Salas further explained when the ancient animal died, its skull might have sunk to the bottom of the seafloor, where it was quickly preserved. The skull, measuring 1.3 meters long, was unveiled at Lima's Museum of Natural History. The Peruvian desert is rich in fossils and offers scientists 42 million years' worth of evolutionary evidence. Other fossils found there include the four-legged dwarf whale and sharks, among others. A painter in Pakistan shifts from trucks to trainers to uncover a hip new canvas for his famous truck art. Haydar Ali says he works on each pair of shoes for up to 4 days, and his paint of choice is mainly acrylic. He also uses other forms of durable material, such as oil paint, to get the job done. The seasoned artist charges select clients $400 for each set. His designs feature intricate bespoke patterns, including flowers, peacocks, and wildly colorful motifs. He says new requests typically arrive every 4 days. Orders for painted trainers started pouring in for the truck artist after a surge of social media interest.
Ideas keep popping up for me, and sometimes clients have ideas. A client came to me from the US asking for a painting on some shoes. I told him an exorbitant fee to discourage him, but he agreed, so I decided, let's do it then.
He has dispatched 8 pairs to various places in Pakistan and abroad since he first started painting trainers in January. Ali comes from a family of truck artists who made a living off of painting lorries. He came to international fame when his work was exhibited at a museum in the U.S. 2 decades ago. So far, the veteran truck artist has applied his craft to an airplane as well as a passenger car, among others. The art form is mainly seen on Pakistani trucks, and today, the trade is one of the country's most famous cultural exports.
Archaeologists have discovered a 500-year-old Aztec altar with 164 in Mexico City, Mexico's largest starfish offering discovered to date. Archaeologists believe it was built around the year 1500. Jaguar bones and other remains such as seashells were also found. Scientists believe the fossils found correspond to a species known as chocolate chip sea star or Nidorella armata.
This is really interesting because if you think about it, chocolate chip sea star looks like the skin of a jaguar. It's orange with dark spots. Probably that is why this species was selected, but we still need to analyze all the starfish because we found 160 of them and we think they all belong to the same species. But we need to research further every one of them.
According to experts, the location of the altar within the Templo Mayor complex and the jaguar motifs suggest the offering was related to the war. Mexico is brimmed with archaeological sites of several civilizations, including Aztecs.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Although still considered a contentious subject by policymakers and the public, there is strong scientific consensus that high meat consumption is extremely harmful to us and the environment. We now present you an article written by Dennis Campbell. The piece is titled UK Supermarkets Charged with Bombarding Shoppers with Cheap Meat. Britain's biggest supermarkets stand charged with bombarding shoppers with offers of cheap meat, despite pledging to promote more meat-free diets to improve health and tackle global heating. Research found that they are using money-saving promotions, such as two for the price of one, as a way of pushing meat, at odds with moves in the United Kingdom and globally for consumers to eat less meat. According to a report from the charity Eating Better, Tesco, Sainsbury's, Asda and Morrisons are each offering scores of deals every week on meat products, such as burgers and sausages, to drive sales and boost their profits. It is an umbrella group representing more than 60 organisations, including the World Wildlife Fund UK, Greenpeace, public health bodies, dietitians, the RSPCA, and food charities. The report also discloses that only 1% of the many hundreds of multi-buy offers for meat products examined by researchers will be banned when the government's crackdown on the promotion of foodstuffs that are high in fat, salt, or sugar to tackle childhood obesity begins in October. Marketing of such foods will be outlawed on television before the 9 p.m. watershed, and also online, though the food industry is trying to persuade ministers to delay or water down both plans. Simon Billing, Eating Better's executive director, said, "Supermarkets are bombarding us with buy one, get one free burgers, sausages and cheap chicken of unknown origin, putting profit before population health and that of the planet." Simon Billing added, "The big four are contradicting their own commitments by encouraging customers to buy more meat than they would have if it hadn't been on promotion. The impact of this is that we're eating more meat than we need or is good for us. Pushing cheap meat into our baskets also supports intensive animal farming, which is wrecking the planet, emitting a huge amount of greenhouse gases and requiring massive amounts of our precious resources such as land and water." The UK Government Commission National Food Strategy, published last July, said Britons needed to reduce their intake of meat by 30% by 2032 in order to help combat the UK's plague of dietary ill health and a climate emergency. It said such a dramatic fall was significant and it won't be easy to achieve, but was vital to help reduce methane emissions from livestock farming and free up land so it could be used to store carbon. While meat intake in Britain is falling slowly, people still eat almost double the global average. The food strategy also noted that our taste for ruminants is a major contributor to climate change. Major changes needed to be made to the national diet within a decade to meet health, climate and nature commitments, including Britons eating 30% more fruit and vegetables, 50% more fibre, 25% less junk food containing high levels of fat, salt or sugar, and 30% less meat. The government's Climate Change Committee has also said people should reduce their intake of meat by 20 to 50% to help the UK meet its target of reaching net zero emissions by 2050. Eating Better's report on the promotion of meat sales is based on research by Question Mark Foundation, a European research institute based in the Netherlands. It examined all promotions for meat and fish that the four food chains put on their websites over 5 weeks last August and September. It found that while Morrison's and Asda ran 1,490 and 1,300.